From Irmo to Istanbul, from Taipei to Tunisia, we tell the stories of the people who make the world of international disputes turn. We give glimpses into their lives and give insights from their experience. These accounts come from every sector and every industry from around the globe. Simply put, and without further ado, I am Chris Campbell, and you're listening to Tales of the Tribunal, where practice meets personality. Welcome to a very special episode of Tales of the Tribunal, a partnership episode that we're doing as the first in a series of episodes that we will do on a quarterly basis, even when we're in season, with the Chartered Institute of Arbitrators North America branch. We're calling the series Arbitration Horizons, Tales from the Chartered Institute North America. And, well, I know what you might be thinking, but Chris, you're not in season six yet. Where's season six? We're working on it, okay? Season six, it's coming. We content creators get restless in between seasons, even when we're bringing you the news and other things going on around the world of international law, business, and dispute resolution. And so, this very special episode to kick off this series features a member of the North America branch of the Chartered Institute, and it's in honor of March 8th, which is International Women's Day, and that's how we're celebrating it here on the show. So, our very first program of this quarterly series will feature Ms. Maureen Byers, arbitrator. She's a nationally recognized top arbitrator, and since 1995 has served as an arbitrator and chairperson in hundreds of arbitrations throughout the United States, involving a variety of business disputes, many of which are presented in complex commercial issues. Maureen is a member of several ADR organizations, including the American Arbitration Association's Large and Complex Case Panel, a fellow and a chartered arbitrator with the Chartered Institute of Arbitrators, and the International Institute for Conflict Prevention and Resolution. She is also on the roster of the National Arbitration and Mediation and fellow of the College of Commercial Arbitrators. So, we're excited to bring you this conversation. Maureen was a great guest, had a lot of perspective on international arbitration, how it's evolved, how we've made progress in terms of DE&I, which is something that we talk about a great deal on the show, and also thoughts for the future for the field. So, sit back and enjoy this conversation, and we'll be back on the other side to wrap up. Hello and welcome back to Tales of the Tribunal with Chris Campbell. I'm your host, Chris Campbell, here to tell you another tale, another story from around the wide, wide world of international law, business, and dispute resolution. Now, listeners, you might be thinking, Tales of the Tribunal, the vis moot hasn't happened yet. Why are you back in my podcast feed a couple of months early? Well, it's because we have an exciting initiative to announce to you, and it is a partnership with the Chartered Institute of Arbitrators North America branch for a special run of the show. And to kick off this special run of the show, we are celebrating International Women's Day. And by doing so, we're having a very special guest today, Ms. Maureen Byers, who is an arbitrator, a lawyer, a seasoned practitioner, and we're going to have a great conversation with her today. Maureen, welcome to the show.
Great to be here, Chris. Thanks for inviting me.
Fantastic. And so, listen, even though this is not a regular seasonal episode of Tales of the Tribunal, we're going to start off with the question that we ask all of our guests here at the show. Who are you? Where are you from? What do the people need to know?
Well, I'm Maureen Byers. I'm a lawyer who serves as a neutral in commercial disputes. I'm based out of Phoenix, Arizona and New York City. I was born, raised, went to school, started my legal career in New York, and I'm delighted to be with you today to celebrate International Women's Day.
Fantastic. And look, there are plenty of threads to pull from there. First of all, happy International Women's Day.
Thank you.
And secondly, let's roll it back just a little bit. So, you say that you split your time between New York and Arizona. Where's home? Where'd you grow up?
Well, I grew up on Long Island, went to school in upstate New York, went to law school in New York City, and started my legal career in New York. After I graduated from college, I was a bit unsure what my career path would be. So I started working for a law firm in New York City as a paralegal. And shortly thereafter, I decided to go to law school after I had saved up enough money to pay for my first year. And after graduating from law school, I worked at Morgan Lewis, a big law firm in New York. Well, the New York City office of Morgan Lewis, which is itself a very large office, but it's also a huge law firm. And then in 1995, I moved to Arizona and started practicing at a medium-sized law firm in Phoenix. And once my work as a neutral grew and became a significant part of my practice, I started a commercial litigation and dispute resolution boutique law firm in Phoenix. And that's where I am now. And since I have my own law firm, I was able to create a presence back in New York. And I go back and forth to New York from Arizona several times a year.
Very well, very well. So thank you for fleshing out that sort of background a little bit. One thing that I guess I'm always curious about is, you know, you were notably someone that was practicing lawyer and that has more so become more of a neutral, both, I guess, in the realm of ADR, where did that inspiration come from? What was it? Was there any sort of specific case experience or a pivotal moment that drove you into the world of ADR?
Well, when I was practicing in New York at Morgan Lewis, I did securities defense litigation and arbitration. And so I served as counsel in several arbitrations in a defense capacity. And I really enjoyed the work. And that's how, and as I became more experienced as a practitioner and a counselor in the ADR setting, then I decided to try my hand at being an arbitrator and neutral in that same setting.
And well, now years on, I'm going to go ahead and assume that you enjoyed it. You have a good time sitting as a neutral.
Oh, absolutely. I really do like it. I enjoy it very much. I wasn't crazy about being an advocate, but I do like being a neutral.
That's fair enough. That's fair enough. And so as the listeners may have picked up on, as you sit as neutral, so that implies that you do both mediation and arbitration. Is that right? Do you do both?
I do. I do serve as both a mediator and an arbitrator, but I've been serving as an arbitrator for a very long time, since 1995. So that's coming up on 30 years. I'm very comfortable in that role, and maybe for that reason alone, I prefer to do it over mediation. I started serving as a mediator only about 8-10 years ago, and while I've been able to help many companies resolve their disputes, I still find I'm finding my own style. I'm still kind of exploring how to do it best based on my own personality. It's really more of an art than a science.
Sure. I think most folks would agree.
Yeah, I think I'm more of an arbitrator scientist slash than a mediator artist.
No, I get it. So as sitting as arbitrator, then are there, you probably have experience with a bunch of different types of institutions. Have there been any that you've appeared under or appointed by with more frequently than others, or?
I am primarily with the American Arbitration Association. That's where I get most of my work, but I'm also on various panels with CPR, the International Institute for Conflict Prevention and Resolution, that's sometimes known as CPR. I'm with Resolute Systems, the National Arbitration and Mediation, known as NAM, N-A-M. And of course, I'm a chartered arbitrator with the Chartered Institute of Arbitrators. But those are the primary, in addition to getting cases ad hoc, people will just contact me and ask me to hear cases without having an administering institution. I'll just take cases ad hoc.
Sure. No, that makes sense. And so I guess having sat under so many different institutions and over the course of your career, I bet you must have seen everything from common law, civil law, maybe a bunch of different legal traditions. Have you sat under civil law as well since you're a common law trained lawyer?
No. I have not, which is really kind of remarkable because I've had hundreds of cases, but I have never had a case where I have had to construe civil law. I'm fascinated by the process. I have seen the process in action. I'm looking forward to doing it, but I have not done it.
Okay, that's fair enough. And well, and about you as an arbitrator, I mean, do you tend to be, you know, proactive, more reserved, somewhere in between? How do you tend to see your role as an arbitrator?
Well, I'm a firm believer that what makes arbitration a great tool for dispute resolution is that it's a process that's dictated by the parties themselves. There's no judge dictating the process. And I don't presume to know the case or the history of the parties and therefore know what's best for them. Their agreement tells me how to proceed. And that agreement could change. For example, it's not unusual at all for a dispute to arise many years after the parties have signed an agreement that has a dispute resolution mechanism to it. And now that the dispute has arisen, I give the parties an opportunity to revise that agreement to make it work for them now. But once the agreement either is or is not revised, it's my opportunity to just sit back and follow that agreement, because that's what the parties have decided to do. And it's my job to follow that, now, unlike a judicial process where, you know, pretty much anything can happen so long as it's within the four corners of the law.
Well, sure. No, that's a great perspective. I think, you know, sometimes you do sort of hear people that describe arbitrators as private judges. And I get that analogy, you know, especially if it's sort of easy to make that comparison. But I always kind of felt like it's always missing something, because I don't quite see it one-to-one example as arbitrators are just private judges. I don't know if you have any thoughts on that.
Oh, I agree 100%. I mean, yes, in a way you're a private judge because you're the fact finder, but you're the mm-hmm. private judge in the context of the room that they've built for you, and you need to stay inside that room. So for example, if you might be outraged at some conduct, but if you don't have the power to, for example, award punitive damages, you can't. And so you're not a private judge in that respect. You're not correcting a wrong. And there's all kinds of, you know, examples like that, you know, where if the agreement ties your hands, you're not just a private judge. You are a tool of the parties. And you have to use that tool or be that tool the way they want you to be.
Yeah, no, I think that makes a lot of sense. And well, look, last question I'm going to ask about kind of your thoughts and you're wearing your arbitrator hat. And this conversation wouldn't be complete if we didn't talk about, you know, what everyone has been buzzing about in the international legal community when it comes to document production versus U.S. style discovery, and whether 1782 might extend to give foreign tribunals the right to order that. I don't know. Do you have any sort of general thoughts when it comes to document productions, whether you have any preference towards expansive, limited, somewhere in between, anything like that?
Well, you're right. It certainly is a hot topic these days. And I appreciate why, but let me give you the classic lawyerly response to that. It depends. Having said that, though, I also have to make sure that the parties receive a fair hearing. If they can't get access to information that they need, they may not get a fair hearing, and then that's on me. So it's always a delicate balance, I think, between fairness and efficiency. But even beyond that, there's a question of proportionality. Even if the information that a party needs to receive is important, if it'll cost more to retrieve it and produce it than the case is worth, does that party still have a right to receive it? These are the kinds of calculations I think that you need to make. And I think that's especially true these days with ESI, electronically stored information. You know, it's not like you could just go to a file cabinet and say, okay, you know, claimant or respondent, you know, you can go rifle through that file cabinet. That's where the information is. I mean, these days, everything has to be retrieved and searched, and they've got to have search terms. And you got to go back through perhaps, data tapes and whatnot. And it's just not so cheap. And the arbitrator has to bear that in mind, that this is an expensive process to make the parties go through that exercise. So that's a long-winded answer, Chris.
Not long-winded at all. I think, well, more long-winded than discovery process itself.
Right. Which can take months and months and months.
That's right. And it could just be, like you say, really voluminous. And I guess, while showing at least my age a little bit and sort of the dated reference, it kind of goes back to the sort of trope of the poor first year, second year associate sitting in a warehouse full of boxes and trying to sort of leaf through all these things. Now it's just a digital data room of trying to sort through all of that sort of stuff.
Absolutely. I was one of those associates. I remember being in Omaha, Nebraska, in an unheated warehouse in the middle of winter, rifling through boxes looking for documents that needed to be produced. Those, I mean, believe it or not, I think that was cheaper than what we have now.
Yeah. Well, yeah, especially, and I think, something we'll talk a little bit about later will be, especially depending on how the technology is implemented, the algorithms, the machine learning capabilities. Yes, those are faster, more powerful tools. Does that mean there's now more documents? Does that mean there's now more cost? So we'll have to talk about that in a little bit. But before we get there, I want to talk about a role that you served aside from your mediator or your arbitrator, or even your counsel positions. And I want to talk about the fact that you served as the co-chair for Women in Dispute Resolution. Can you tell us a little bit more about that organization and what you did with your time there?
Sure. The American Bar Association has a dispute resolution section, and the dispute resolution section has a committee named Women in Dispute Resolution, which WIDR, WIDR is the acronym, which is maybe an unfortunate acronym for those of us who don't want to think about their thighs. But WIDR was founded about 12 years ago to promote the selection of women and other diverse arbitrators, mediators, and dispute resolution professionals. It was exhilarating work. They're just a group of really brilliant women who were very talented neutrals and frustrated with being the only and often the token woman on an arbitration panel. While I was co-chair in 2018, along with others at WIDR, we succeeded in having the ABA adopt Resolution 105, which was a call to action for companies, counsel, and ADR service providers to take concrete steps to end the exclusion of women and other diverse individuals from serving as arbitrators, neutrals, and other various capacities.
Wow.
And I think that's helped. I think, I don't certainly wasn't the end all and the be all, but the fact that the ABA came out and said we have to start doing better at hiring women as neutrals was a good step forward.
I think so too. And I wonder, with that step and some other steps that have been taken over the last decades, years, but still recognizing that we still have a long way to go, I kind of would be curious to get your thoughts on what you think the current status of the diversity discussion, or maybe diversity progress, is in international practice, I guess, ADR in particular, arbitration and mediation.
Well, I think things have gotten better. I've actually served on a single panel of three women, which was unheard of when I started back in 1995. But the fact that I've only had one is in itself a little troubling. But it's not unusual now for me to be on a panel with another woman. It was unusual for me to be on a panel with other men.
I guess the question that I might have then, Maureen, would be, What do you think about the current state of diversity in international ADR? And I guess that means progress, maybe what the status is currently as it goes to firms or counsel appointments, arbitrator appointments, any of those types of things when we talk about diversity, as broadly as that term can be defined?
I think it's gotten better. It's nice to be able to serve on a panel where there's another woman or another diverse individual. That was by far not the case when I started in 95 and was not the case even 10 years ago. I was still almost always the only woman. Recently served on a panel of three women, which was terrific. But I think companies have become a lot more cognizant, and I think they're ahead of the game. Most international companies have very robust diversity initiatives, and I think that trickles down to who they pick for counsel and who they pick for arbitrators, which is, a step in the right direction. But we still have a long way to go. And now there's an active backlash against diversity, equity, and inclusion that will have to be overcome. So sometimes I think it's two steps forward and one step back.
Yeah. And I think that's at least a lot of the part of conversations that I'm in these days is how do we not only think about progress that can be made, but ensure that we don't lose ground that was hard fought in the past decades. Because I think that's very easy to concede those points if you're not vigilant and not intentional in preserving that progress.
Yes, absolutely.
I guess one more question before we leave sort of your ABA experience. What is if you're still aware, if you're still involved with the organization, how can others get involved, or how can women get involved with this group? Do you have any tips there?
Sure. There's a couple of ways. I mean, you can get involved through the American Bar Association, join the dispute resolution section, and you become a part of the committee just by your own election. There's no additional fee or anything. So I would encourage that. Another way is that they have a very active LinkedIn page, which you can follow. And be involved in that respect, even if you don't want to join the ABA or join the dispute resolution section of the ABA. And then each state has a wider representative that helps women in the state, in each state, get more involved in ADR and help promote each other. In the ADR field, I'm the person in charge of Arizona, and we have put together a collection of women who are otherwise unaffiliated with each other, and we run an ad in the Arizona Attorney 6 times a year, and it's just an opportunity for people to meet the women neutrals in Arizona and make sure that we're out there.
Fantastic. So if we've got that, and we'll include some links in the show notes, it starts with, at least with this organization, with the ABA, and in particular, the dispute resolution section. And there's a state rep in across all the 50 United States. And if you're in Arizona, you call Maureen.
That's right.
Okay, fair enough. Talking a little bit more about arbitration once again, and we'll have just a couple of questions to wrap up on that topic. I wonder if, especially from your perspective across the areas of practice and having been in the field for some years now, what are some challenges that you think faced the practice of arbitration and dispute resolution in that?
One of the challenges, I think, is to be mindful. I think arbitrators need to be very mindful of the costs of arbitration. You know, it's not just the fee that they pay to the institution that might be administering the arbitration, which is really not very much money, but the fees of the arbitrators can really add up. And I think you need to be mindful of that when arbitrators set their hourly or daily rate. Parties choose arbitration because it's cheaper. Also, they choose it because it might be private, which may be an important factor for them, but it's supposed to be cheaper and faster than litigation. And I think arbitrators have to be mindful of that when they set their rates and they charge for things. If arbitrators charge excessive fees or excessive costs, then arbitration has become on par with litigation, and we don't want that to happen and lose that benefit. I think it's also another challenge that you see in the cases, and I find it troubling, is lack of proper disclosures. Because this is fairly unreviewable, in an arbitration award, I think arbitrators need to be extremely careful about making sure that they don't have any prior relationships with the lawyers, the parties, the witnesses. And what I fear is that arbitrators will get sloppy with their disclosures. The mantra, of course, for all arbitrators is disclose, disclose, disclose. And it's not up to you to decide whether it's a significant disclosure or a trivial disclosure. You've got to disclose it and let the parties decide whether it's what might be trivial for me, it might be important to the parties. So I don't think there's such a thing as over disclosure. But there's an uptick I see in cases challenging arbitrators for the lack of disclosure. And it troubles me greatly because it looks bad for all arbitrators when a single arbitrator fails to make an important disclosure, or any disclosure for that matter.
Okay. No, I think that that's, I think your first point on costs, both in terms of finance and time, you're preaching to the choir. As an end user of the process, you know, those are always things that we're consciously thoughtful about, how long things are going to take, how long it's going to take, and what's it going to cost. And then I think, I haven't had this issue personally, but you know, you hear stories about, you know, you get all the way to the end of a multi-year arbitration battle only to disclose that, you know, someone actually used to practice law with a counsel, or, you know, they were at the same firm at some point, or some things that were just really easily to disclose, but someone decided not to, and now you've put the whole process in jeopardy, and put the parties having to start back from square one. I mean, that's a nightmare situation.
Yes, yes. And I'm not saying it's intentional, but you just have to do it. You can't be sloppy about it.
Absolutely. And well, look, you know, before sort of leaving a couple of these topics behind, I'd be remiss if I didn't talk about the folks at the banner of this episode, the Chartered Institute of Arbitrators. Tell us, how did you get involved with the Chartered Institute? And what has your experience been like with them and all those types of
things? Well, it's been a great experience. I've had the opportunity to meet some of the most talented and respected arbitrators in the world. And I'm so grateful for the opportunity to meet them and learn from them. I became involved with the organization back in 2010. I decided I wanted to, after spending many years as an arbitrator, I wanted to spend more time in the international arena. But you can't just walk into that. You've got to get some training. And the Chartered Institute provides the most comprehensive training and certification out there. So I took the courses and the exams, and I obtained my fellowship with the Institute. And once I did that, I wanted to take it a step further and become a chartered arbitrator so that I could be included in their roster of arbitrators.
And well, then the natural question would be, for those out there thinking about maybe joining the Chartered Institute, was it worth it? Is it something that you would recommend?
Oh, I definitely would, without question. I mean, just to be able to participate in some of the programming that they have is worth every penny. Recently, we had a retreat in New Mexico for the North American branch of the Chartered Institute, and it was just, you know, top-rate programming and an opportunity to hobnob with some of the best of the best. And you know, I mean, that it was just a great experience. I'm looking forward for, they're having another one this spring. I'm looking forward to continue to participate in that way.
Yeah, I think that makes that's a great point. And so for me, whenever I go to London, for example, I usually try to make it by the office at some point. Or I've used one of the rooms at the office actually to record an episode of this show.
I've never been to the London office, and I was just in London. I should have thought about that.
Well, next time, Maureen, you absolutely have to stop by. The staff is great. If you let them know that you're coming in ahead, they can set up a room for you, and they have a very lovely office. You would very much enjoy that, I think. And in fact, look, I will give a shout out to one of our friends in the Chartered Institute office and a former guest on this show, Mercy McBrayer, who worked for the Chartered Institute there. So, Mercy, if you're listening, and we're going to tag you when we post this, shout out to you. Listen, shifting topics just a little bit here. One of the things I'm always curious to hear from folks that stop by the digital studio is, they've had usually had really interesting careers, have done a lot of different things. I wonder what have been some of the career influences or sort of guiding forces? Maybe it was a mentor, maybe it was a role model, any of those types of things that you think may have helped shape your philosophy, or where you are today.
Well, I don't know that it was anyone in my professional life, but I'll tell you that my parents had a profound effect on my career. They were hardworking, lower middle class folks who, they grew up with nothing. Gave myself and my siblings everything they had. My dad, it wasn't unusual for him to have three or four jobs at a time. I mean, just really had a very strong work ethic in my family, which was instilled in me and my siblings. And so, rolling up your sleeves and doing a good job has always been something that, I take to heart. And that what I learned from them was that there's no substitute for that. You could have all the connections and the money in the world, but if you're not willing to work hard, if you're not willing to work, be an honest person, you're not going to get anywhere. And I've carried that through my career. So I can't say that I owe anyone anything more than what I owe my folks for teaching me that.
I think that's a great, professional or personal life influence, or otherwise. I think that's a great idea. I mean, that's a fantastic, beautiful notion, Maureen. Let me ask you this question, a little bit of a lighter question, or I say lighter, it might be actually, it might be really hard. What's on your bookshelf right now? What are you reading?
On my bookshelf. Well, on my bookshelf is a stack of New Yorkers that I haven't gotten to yet. But then they're dense, and it takes me, I read them from cover to cover, so it takes me a while to get through them. But I'm also on a quest to visit all the US national parks. And this summer, I'm going to northern Minnesota to visit Voyageurs National Park and Isle Royale National Park. And I learned recently that there's an author named Nevada Barr who writes mysteries based in national parks. And so I'm reading her book now, called Winter Study, which takes place on Isle Royale. So that's a light book. It's hardly War and Peace, but that's my escape.
But really fascinating. Both, that's a really interesting interesting goal of yours. But that there's an author who like has focused on only writing stories, mysteries in particular, out of national parks. That's got a she's got a niche there, I gotta say.
I don't know if it's all she does, but I've just got turned on to her recently, and this particular book is in a national park, and I think she has at least one other that's in a national
I was going to say, how far along are you in this journey? Have you made it to
park.
a great number of them? I mean, are you at the beginning, middle, near the end, or
Almost all of them. I'm near the end. I've got a couple of big ones that I still haven't been to, like Crater Lake National Park in Oregon. But last summer, my husband and I spent about a month going to all eight parks in Alaska, two of which were above the Arctic Circle, and you have to take a seaplane to them. So it was quite an adventure. So I'm almost there.
And so, well, look, I promise I won't judge you based on your answer here. You've certainly been to South Carolina already.
I have been.
Okay, all right,
I
that's the
have
right
been.
answer.
I have been. Yes, I have. And in fact, getting back to my dad, that his he was on a submarine for many years when he was young, and his submarine is based right outside of Charleston for many years.
Okay.
It has now it's now all rusted up.
Sure. Yes, I'd imagine so. Well, very cool. Very cool. That's I think one of the more creative answers we've gotten to the reading question. What do you listen to? What kind of music do you like? Any favorite artist?
Well, I'm one of the younger baby boomers. I grew up with the Beatles and the Rolling Stones, and I'm still a dyed-in-the-wool rock and roll hippie. Probably my newer favorite artist is Gary Clark Jr. But I'm a big fan of the Foo Fighters and Green Day and Pearl Jam and Ed Sheeran.
Sure. All greats.
Still listen to the oldies, though.
Well, yeah. You know, I think the classics and old school definitely has, you know, it's hard to know where you're going or to really appreciate even some of the new music. And in fact, speaking to my younger brothers who are definitely not listening because they are teenagers. But they do edit the show, so they may listen well. You know, they will ask me about what I listen to. And music that I will quote from my teenage years or my early 20s, and they'll say, oh yeah, that's like a classic.
Yeah, makes you feel old real fast.
It does. But what you do hear in the music, and this is what I love about it, is that when you listen to the things that are coming out now, you hear the influences from who those artists clearly enjoyed or took inspiration from. So that's always kind of cool.
Absolutely.
All right. So we're coming towards the end of our time together, Maureen. But before we get there, I have two questions for you. The first one is, if you were approached by a current or recent graduate or someone that is looking to break into the field of international arbitration, what advice or tips would you give them?
You know, when I was a law clerk for a federal judge, in my early career, when I first got out of law school, I observed a lot of criminal trials, and I noticed that the best criminal defense lawyers were former prosecutors. And I kind of adopted that into my arbitration practice in a strange way. I kind of folded that notion into my career. I spent many years litigating commercial disputes, and I think that helped me be a good arbitrator. I would pass that on to someone who's starting out. You have more credibility issuing orders if you actually have been on the receiving end of that order and know what it's like to comply with it. I think knowing what it's like to be in the trenches, knowing what it's like to be on the other side of that, and I'll call it a bench, even though it's not a bench, knowing what it's like to be on the other side of that bench really helps you out to become a good arbitrator. So don't be too anxious to jump into the neutral role without having a fair amount of experience being an advocate in that arena. I think it definitely helps you.
Yeah, I think that's well said. And, you know, oftentimes, I don't know if you get these questions too, you'll come across someone that will have done the VIS, which is an international arbitration moot, or something similar, and they'll have been, understandably so, sort of infatuated with international practice. And they'll promptly say, I want to be an international lawyer or an arbitrator. I'm ready to do this tomorrow. And you'll say, okay, you know, maybe have to learn how to like file a pleading, how to appear
right,
in court first.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, you want to be able to understand what, when you're issuing an order, you want to be able to understand, okay, what am I making this person do? How is this person going to prepare? How long does that person need to do it? If you haven't been on the other side of it and done it, it's going to be hard to decide. It's going to be hard to issue an order that makes sense.
And I think that's exactly the point. You know, it's never the advice of, you know, I don't like the expression of people need to pay their dues or feel like, you know, you have to wait. But I think it's not so much about the waiting. It's more that you have to learn how to do it.
Exactly. I mean, you don't become Jimi Hendrix overnight. You've got to practice, practice, practice. You've got to learn. You've got to learn how to do it. You've got to do your 10,000 hours. Is that what it is?
Yeah.
I don't know if it's 10,000 hours to be a good arbitrator, but to be, you know, really good at what you do, you've got to put in the time.
Absolutely. And I think that is always something that I appreciate, that, you know, I do think that there's a balance, you know, in terms of, there can be too far in that principle where I think working in quote unquote hustle culture can become toxic. But to your point, and to the point that you made from the influences of your parents into your own career, I think that's absolutely, there's no substitute from just sort of figuring out the work that needs to be done, doing that work, and just doing that work over and over and over again until you look up one day and turns out you're pretty good. And so then this will bring us to our conclusory sort of comment here. And I guess this is the hardest question of the interview so far. Let's say it's 5 p.m. on a Friday and you are somehow completely free for the weekend. No orders, no mediation things to worry about. How do you spend your weekend?
Did you say this was a hard question?
The hardest question, in fact, yes.
This is the easiest question. I'm outside hiking with my dogs. No question about it. I am an outside person. I try to spend half my time in Arizona and half my time in New York. And if I've done it right, I'm outside in the winter in Arizona, and I'm outside in the summer in New York, and I'm with my dogs hiking a lot. So that's an easy question. I love being outside, and I kind of set up my lifestyle so I always can be.
That's fantastic. That's a great weekend. Hanging out with the dogs, walking around, enjoying the views. That's a great weekend if I've heard one.
And if one of the kids can join me, that's even better.
Kids optional, dogs mandatory. I get it. Well, that's very good. I do have maybe one more question, and this is a quick one, I think. We're wrapping up here today on International Women's Day, and we appreciate you being our guest. Do you have any final thoughts for International Women's Day? Perhaps it's for, you know, maybe that woman counsel or arbitrator that's maybe going through a hard time or thinking about needs a word of encouragement or anything like that as we sort of wrap up today's conversation.
You know, one thing I can tell you is that the community of women neutrals is very dynamic and extremely supportive. And there are literally dozens of women that will take my phone call or answer my email if I have an issue or something that I need to talk through with them, whether it's about, frustration with parties or counsel or whatever it is, any problem at all, any legal question. It's a terrific network. I would encourage women to and any diverse neutral to get involved in the community of diverse neutrals, because we lean on each other, we support each other. And we're a great resource, and I value it highly, and I would commend it to anybody who is thinking about getting into the world or is already involved in the neutral world. Use the community of expertise that has been created, and the fact that we have these electronic communications makes it so easy for us to keep in touch and to use each other's brains and pick each other's brains.
Well, wonderful. I think that's a great message for International Women's Day and to take forward throughout the rest of the year. So thank you for that. Well, in season or not, the time always goes by way too fast. And I guess maybe even doubly so when we have a special guest coming through. So really enjoyed the conversation, and I look forward to you stopping by some other time. Thanks for being here, Maureen.
It was great to be with you, Chris. Thanks for having me.
Of course. And well, look, before we get out of here, this is kind of our tradition around here. You want to sign us off?
Absolutely. I'm Maureen Byers, and there's no disputing it. You are listening to Tales of the Tribunal.
Thank you, and we will see y'all next time.
So, there you have it. A very special conversation for a very special occasion. And again, thank you so much, Maureen, for being here with us and for the Chartered Institute for using this opportunity to kick off this very special event. I'm excited about all the conversations that we're going to do on this series, and I'm even happier that we got to kick it off on International Women's Day. So, a big celebration, a big appreciation for all the women that make the world a special place. Thank you so much for listening to Tales of the Tribunal this week. We'll be back with more content for you next week with Disputes Digest. And as we march towards season 6 of the show, we look forward to bringing you more Arbitration Horizons, some more episodes with ArbTech, and indeed all the great things that we do here. It's going to be a great 2024, and we appreciate you tuning in. Tales of the Tribunal is brought to you by MoBeta Solutions. Show music is produced by Joshua and Jaden Campbell. So, until next time, there's no disputing it. You're listening to Tales of the Tribunal.
None of the views shared on today or any episode of Tales of the Tribunal is presented as legal advice, nor advice of any kind. No compensation was provided to any person or party for their appearance on the show, nor do any of the statements made represent any particular organization, legal position, or viewpoint. All interviewees appear on an arm's length basis, and their appearances should not be construed as any bias or preferred affiliation with the host or host's employer. All rights reserved.